Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is the carbon footprint of pets. 2 weeks ago, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported that the concentration of heat-trapping carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere is at its highest level in over 3 million years. While there has been a lot of hand-wringing about what humans have done to cause this, what about our pets? Is it time for a sustainable pet movement? Dog ownership has surged in North America, and there are currently more dogs in the United States than children. Hard to believe, but we love our pets. And like humans, these pets eat, play, and yes, they poop. And as with humans, these behaviors tax the Earth's resources. According to the recent Canadian film Dogged Days, directed by one of our guests tonight, one day's worth of dog waste in North America is the equivalent to the mass of 153 blue whales, or about 56,000 blue whales a year. Later in the hour, we'll hear how scientists are finding innovative ways to use this waste. But lest cat owners feel like they're left out of this, don't worry, cat waste too has gotten attention recently because it can carry toxoplasmosis, a parasite harmful to the fragile population of sea otters off the California coast. So pets have an environmental impact, but how bad is it? What should they be eating? What should their toys and their beds and their litter be made of? With a planet supporting 7 billion people and many more pets, what are the simple and not so simple ways pet owners can be kinder to our planet? We hope to uncover answers to these questions and more with our several guests tonight. Joining me by phone is Helen Slinger. She's the director of the film Dog Days, and she's joining us from Vancouver. And this film was partly filmed in the Bay Area and recently aired on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Named one of British Columbia's 100 most influential women, Helen has been a reporter for newspapers and television, and she now focuses primarily on documentaries for Bountiful Films in Vancouver. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you, Joseph.
We're also joined by phone by Holly Say. She's from the Bay Area, tonight is calling us from Toronto, and she writes regularly about green issues for Catster.com, is the author of Make Your Own Cat Toys, and is the creator of GreenLittleCat.com, a blog dedicated exclusively to greener living ideas for cats and cat lovers. Welcome, Holly.
Thank you, Joseph. It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
Great. And also joining us by phone is Professor John Hart. He's part of the Energy and Resources Group and the Ecosystem Sciences Division of the College of Natural Resources at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome, Professor Hart.
Thank you.
And finally, joining me in the studio this evening is Mark Clayman. He is founder of San Francisco's Pet Camp, the first pet lodging facility in the country to be certified a green business by the City and County of San Francisco. Mark previously worked at the Environmental Protection Agency. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Well, pleasure to be here.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our lines in about 20 minutes or so. You can dial 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 to join our conversation. You can also email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. You can post a comment at the KLW website, klw.org, or a comment on our Facebook page. So, Professor Hart, I wanted to start with you. Tell us the ways that pets are impacting our environment. Give us a little bit more detail from what I was able to run off on the introduction there.
Well, I'll say a few words about pets, but what I think is a more important topic and that I'd prefer to talk about at greater length is the problem of global warming and the problem of too many people, not too many pets on the planet. The global warming problem is caused by emissions of gases like carbon dioxide, and pets do make a contribution to that, but not anywhere near as great as the contribution made by people. And the way I like to think about this is that a young couple starting out and making the decision they'd like to have a little live something or other running around in the house, and it would do a lot less harm to the planet to have that little something be a cat rather than a person. So keeping the population down, keeping the growth of population down, ultimately reducing the number of people on the planet is far more important than reducing the number of pets. There are harm from pets. Cats, feral and domestic, are estimated to kill a few billion birds each year. and maybe as many as 10 or 20 billion small mammals. That's a big impact. It's, for example, far bigger than the bird kill from wind energy. Wind turbines are often criticized because they cause bird kills, but actually cats, feral, and other do more harm. So there are impacts. It's annoying to find dog poop in your front yard when a careless neighbor doesn't control their animal. But the real issue is global warming. We use too much of the wrong kind of energy, and we have too many people using the wrong kind of energy, leading to a buildup of greenhouse gases and changes in the climate that are going to be catastrophic if we don't change our energy policy. And that's far more important than changing our pet policy.
And it sounds like you're making some very important points there. And at the same time, our program is focused tonight on the impact that pets have, that marginal impact. If you had to put a number on it, what would you say is the marginal impact that pets have on environmental concerns such as global warming?
It really depends. The studies on this are not definitive. One analysis seemed to indicate that medium to large-sized dog is sort of like equivalent to having an extra car in the family, using a car that otherwise wouldn't be used. I think that's probably an exaggeration. It depends a lot on what the dog is eating. If it's eating meat-based food, that's going to be accompanied by more carbon dioxide emission than if it's on a vegetarian diet. The same is true with people. The kinds of meat that dogs eat and cats eat in dog and cat food is often food that wouldn't be consumed otherwise by people and might just go to waste. So in trying to work out what the impact is, I think it's whatever the number is, and it's controversial, it's small compared to the impact of the dog owner or the cat owner through the consumption of that person, the use of energy, driving, consuming material goods. All of that is so far in excess of the harm that the pets do that I think putting the emphasis on pets is a little misleading. I also think that there are lots of lonely people for whom a dog or a cat is an important companion. So I tend not to come down strongly on pets as a major contributor. They are a contributor, but not anywhere near in the ballpark type contribution that we do, humans.
So I want to turn next to Helen Slinger, and she just her documentary just aired on CBC called Dog Days. So Helen, what's your take on Professor Hart's comments? Specifically, again, what is your understanding after the research you've done regarding the environmental impact of pets, and how big a concern should this be?
Well, John Hart is right on that this is a story about human impact. Of course, that's what our pets are. Is there? We have them. They evolve with us. Dogs. We know more and more about how dogs evolve very much alongside human beings. There's been research really recently that shows that it was their ability, their evolution into being able to handle starch in their diet. That's one of the things that made them evolve so perfectly in tandem with human beings. So obviously it is a story about human impact. It's not, I've heard the same, I don't know if it's a statistic, but the same figure that owning a mid-sized dog is about like owning, I've heard, an SUV, actually, not just another car. So they definitely do have an impact. But I think that fundamental point is a really good one, that, of course, it's the impact of humans that we're talking about here. What I think is interesting about this, and our film looked at the social and environmental impact of dogs when there are so many more of them, and I think John touched on that too, with the notion that in this very urbanized sometimes, I think, alienated kind of society. More people need dogs. For more people are living on their own. People are delaying having children until much later. The dog becomes a very important part of being social, being in the world. So I think they're important in that way, too. But I think one of the most interesting things, and I'll be interested when Mark Clayman from Pet Camp joins the conversation, too, because I think one of the most interesting things about this whole discussion is that dogs can lead the way, I think, because we dwell on them, we dote on them so much. I think they really can lead the way for us looking at our own impact perhaps a little bit differently. It's hard. We rationalize almost everything in our behaviors. I think if we can perhaps use this discussion to look at how we change the dog's impact, maybe that can lead us into looking more at how we change our own impact. We did. You mentioned in your introduction that in our research, one of the first things that we looked at was how much poop, because of course that's one of the flashpoints when people have conflict over dogs, and we ended up with 40,000 tons of poop a day across North America, which is what we got the same scientist that Mark Clayman worked with on his Pet Camp project. We got him to break this down for us. We wanted something that we could visualize because we were doing a documentary. So we did this. We worked this out to be the 153 great blue whales, the largest mammal on Earth, a day across North America. So that's a lot of poop. But the most interesting thing about this is, of course, it doesn't have to be useless. We can turn it into energy, which is one of the things that I know Mark will talk about a little bit later. So I think that's really interesting, because I think if we could get over our squeamishness and if we could stop being so lazy about what we do with dog poop, maybe we could start looking at human waste, too. So I think that's one of the most interesting things. I also thought that John's touch on vegetarian diets for dogs is really interesting, too. My family has in the last while, partly over animal welfare and partly because of global warming, has gone animal-free in terms of our own diets, and our dog eats a lot less than she used to of animal products. So that's a way in which we can minimize the dog's impact and also our own. And one leads you to thinking about the other. And, of course, it is all human impact because we're the ones in control, or we're the ones who think we're in control.
So the good news is that we actually are also in control of the solutions, what you're saying there. Professor Hart, I want to go back to you for a moment. I was thinking about this concern that I've heard about pet food and how the production of the meat that's mostly in the pet food that we serve our dogs and cats has the same concerns that we have with meat and for that's consumed by humans. But this question I'm left with is, a lot of the composition of pet food is meat byproducts. And I'm curious, is there a particular concern about meat byproducts? I would think, oh, meat byproducts, that means we use all of the animal. And in fact, it's a good environmentally sort of pro-environmental movement to use all the pieces of the animal and so to consume it in the process. So is there something particularly concerning to you about the byproducts that are part of pet food?
Well, it's not that they're concerning to me. It's that, in fact, those byproducts could be turned into perfectly acceptable human food. It wouldn't be what we're used to, but look, the way the...
Okay, it sounds like we're having some technical challenges here. Sorry, I think we may have lost our phone guests there. I'm going to check in and see. Helen Slinger, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Do you want to pick up on the point that Professor Hart was trying to make?
Yes. I mean, I think the overall point that he was making is that he was leading to is we need to consume less of everything and less of everything. The creatures, of course, that we eat are creatures, but beyond that, they cost a lot more. They're a much bigger footprint to create. To create a steak costs a hell of a lot more than it costs to create a tofu steak or to eat a bean-based diet. So I think that's possibly part of what he was talking about, is we have to look at whether or not what we're all eating globally, including our pets, and try and lessen that impact. And whether or not you feel that it's fine to eat meat, well, perhaps we ought to be just eating less and less and less of it and eating some of these more, quote-unquote, exotic byproducts. There are many countries in the world that do eat more than, the top sirloin of an animal. And if we're going to eat animals, we should probably be considering that. But that's a huge part of our footprint, of course, is meat consumption. And that's one of the studies that's really interesting over the last couple of years, too, is that your carbon footprint, if you don't eat meat, is, of course, hugely smaller than if you do. So that's just one thing that you can do, and that's one thing that you can have your animal do, is eat. Perhaps you don't want to have your animal on a vegetarian diet. I think to a lot of people that seems really, really odd. But you could put your animal on half a vegetarian diet, where they have half as much meat, in the same way that you might your own family. And that's a way to lessen the impact.
And so let's bring in, our institute guest, Mark Clayman, who is the owner and founder of Pet Camp here in San Francisco, who's actually featured in Helen Slinger's documentary, Dog Days. As you decided to green your business, tell us how you came about the decisions that you did. Why don't you outline those decisions and tell us how you prioritize them?
Well, sure. I mean, we first made our decision to go green in 2000 when California was suffering its rolling blackouts, and everyone was convinced, or at least the people in D.C. were convinced, we needed to drill in Alaska to offset our lack of oil. And of course, it turns out that there were a host of other reasons. But at the same time, we actually are one of those families that has more kids than dogs. We have 4 kids and only 2 dogs right now, and made the decision that we could do something more. We could both run a really good pet care business, keep true to our core mission, and at the same time take on some greening aspects. And the thing we focused on first was our energy consumption. Our electric use at Pet Camp is phenomenal. We have a massive airflow issues. We change the air over in our building every 4.5 minutes. And that just takes a lot of power. And we have a swimming pool that has jets and a heater and, cleaning tools and everything else. It just takes a lot of power. And at the time, our electric bill was $25,000 a year. Last year, to put it in context, it was under $7,000. And so we just started, going through what we could do to offset our carbon footprint, in the pet care world. We put on solar panels. We changed all of our lighting fixtures. We converted all of our power from 120 to 220. We put in what's called high-volume, low-speed fans, which are 20-foot diameter ceiling fans. It looks like a helicopter's landed upside down on the building. They move huge amounts of air, 68,000 cubic feet per minute of air, and only use 58 watts of power. I mean, these are all things we were able to do as a small business to lessen the environmental impact of taking care of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dogs a year, at the same time being true to our core mission. Because I think it's really important that both what Professor Hart said and what Helen said about, dogs and cats are part of our family. So we need to integrate their care into the care of our environment and the care of our lives. I mean, they're part of our lives. They're part of our environment. We need to figure out a way to do this better collectively.
So, Professor Hart, sorry we lost you there for a moment in mid-sentence, but I understand we have you back on. Is that correct?
I am back on.
Okay, great.
Somehow went off.
Okay. So I was just going to ask you for a couple of closing comments. I know you can't be with us for the entire hour. So if you can give us a couple of closing comments about the concerns we've outlined so far and how to inspire pet owners to really take responsibility for the contribution to greenhouse gases that come through the practices of caring for their pets. What things would you highlight for them?
Well, let me finish the thought about food.
Sure, go ahead.
On when the phone disconnected. The world is going to face it's starting to face, and it's going to get worse, a massive crisis of providing enough food for the 7 billion people now on the planet, and population is expected, if we don't take further action, it's expected to grow to 9 or 10 billion by the end of this century. How are we going to feed those people? And we really don't know. And the problem is that with the worsening climate, with increasing frequency of drought, with increasing soil erosion, agriculture is going to be up against a major crisis. And it's not just going to be a crisis in the very poorest countries. It's going to be a crisis in many, many parts of the world, because a good climate is necessary to grow food, and we're losing that climate with global warming. So things like the kind of food that now gets fed to pets is going to be necessary to feed people. And we're not going to be able to grow enough food to feed 9 billion people and the pets that all of those people would like to have. So the first thing to do is not to focus on the pets, but to focus on population growth of humans and to focus on consumption. We have to avert the worst of global warming by reducing carbon emissions, and we know how to do that. The way to do it is to convert from fossil fuels to clean renewables and to use energy more efficiently.
So, Professor Hart, I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Professor John Hart in the Energy and Resources Group and the Ecosystem Sciences Division of the College of Natural Resources at the University of California at Berkeley. And we just want to take a moment to ask for your support. As you may know by now, we're in the midst of our spring membership campaign here at KLW. And I'm going to turn it over briefly to our general manager, Matt Martin, who's joining us to ask for your support.
Thank you, Joseph. You know, a program like City Visions and a station like KALW is a collaboration of so many people bringing their energies together. The guests tonight bringing their expertise to the air, the producers of City Visions and hosts of City Visions who are themselves volunteers, people from this community who give of themselves to this station and therefore to people across the Bay Area. And twice a year, we come to you as a listener and say, what can you bring? What can you do to help us grow this resource that serves the entire community? If you are someone who listens to a program like City Visions and here's an issue like this broken down, people offering their critical perspectives from their own knowledge base and appreciate that kind of thoughtful discussion, show your support now with a call at 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917, or you can go online to KALW.org. We have a goal of 12 people making contributions to KALW during this hour, and if we make it to that goal, Barry Thorne, who's a generous listener in Berkeley, will put forward an additional $800 for KALW. 800-525-9917. This is a time in our spring campaign when your support will make a big impact. You can also go to KALW.org, make a pledge there, get yourself a thank you gift if you'd like. Your support is critical. It's all of us coming together that makes it happen. We want to end this campaign on time, and that means just 2 days from now on Wednesday. Help make sure it's a success so this non-interrupting short campaign can work. You can show the world and make this a better way to do public radio fundraising. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Joseph, back to you.
Thanks very much, Matt. And this is City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco local powered radio and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're discussing the carbon footprint of pets with our guests. We heard just a moment ago from Professor John Hart of the University of California at Berkeley. And our remaining guests tonight are Holly Say, who we'll hear from in a moment. She's writer about green issues for Catster.com and creator of GreenLittleCat.com and author of Make Your Own Pet Toys, which you'll hear a little bit more about in just a moment. We're also joined by Helen Slinger. She's calling us from Vancouver, Canada this evening, and she's director of a recent documentary which aired on the CBC called Dog Dazed, which actually features one of our other guests this evening, Mark Clayman, founder of and owner of Pet Camp here in San Francisco. And once you've made a pledge to KLW, why don't you take a moment to call in with your questions and comments. The number to dial is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Are you doing something to be a greener pet owner that you could share with your fellow listeners? Are you curious about minimizing the environmental impact or of something that your pet does? 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment at klw.org. So Holly Tsai, who's been waiting patiently in Toronto, I believe, welcome to the program. Holly, are you there? Okay, it sounds like we don't have Holly, so let's go back. Let's go back to Helen Slinger. So, Helen, let us sort of break down in the next few minutes the major areas. We've talked a lot about the environmental impact of poop, and then we touched briefly on how the food that we use to feed our pets can also have an environmental impact that we need to reconsider. Let's run through some other areas that we need to bring to our listeners' attention.
Can we just, before we do that, can we go back to poop one more time?
I was warned by my producer that it was going to be at the top of your list.
No,
so I'm
no, I think it's,
I'm fully prepared.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Because I think this is Mark, having filmed with Mark and filmed at Pet Camp, I know he did a good job of describing all the stunning things they've done to bring down their impact. There's one thing that they've, one other thing that he didn't get to, and that's poop. They send their poop from Pet Camp to another facility, and it is actually turned into power now. The reason that I got involved with wanting to film Pet Camp was because Mark had gone a little bit further, trying to, on the spot, turn the waste that's created, we can say waste, not just poop, the waste that's created into methane on the spot and using it right there to power his facility. Now, I think it's a brilliant idea, and it's that kind of out-of-the-box thinking that we all need to solve the environmental mess that we're in. I thought that was stunning. It got stopped, I understand, and I'm sure Mark can talk about this more, it got stopped at the regulatory level. Like, it was just so difficult to get all the bodies that have to make decisions to permit such an innovative idea to fall in line to make it happen. And that's the kind of thing that I think is just we all need to support, we all need to be aware of, and push our legislators to be able to take some of these bolder steps when someone in the community is willing to. There was another, with the same technology that Mark was interested in, there was another project of street light that burned through a summer in Cambridge that was powered right on the spot with dog waste. So if your dog did his business in a little dog park, you deposited in a methane digester, which just looked like a couple of barrels, turn the barrels, it begins to digest the waste and turns it into methane gas, which powers the street light. It just tells you that things can be done and done so directly if people are willing to be a little bit more innovative. And one of the things that Mark nicely provided for us in the documentary is this notion that, you know, if dogs can do it, well, maybe a little dog shall lead us and we can get humans doing it too. And I know I already made that point, but I wanted to just both give the props to Mark for moving that forward, and also encourage Mark in San Francisco to push at such a forward-thinking city, to push at the regulators to try and move forward this kind of innovation.
And Mark, did you want to tell us a little bit about where you got stuck in this process?
Well, first of all, Helen, thank you so much for those very nice comments. I mean, we got stuck in the process of, you know, we are a small business. We don't have an environmental engineer on staff. We don't have someone to really evaluate all these projects. I mean, it is one of these things where we do because I care a great deal about it, and we think it can better both the environment and be a showcase. I mean, frankly, if Pet Camp can do this kind of stuff, frankly, anyone can do this kind of stuff. And if we can make this kind of impact at a very small local level at a small business like us, you know, we could be doing a lot more both at the city level of San Francisco, notwithstanding its best efforts and its mantras, and certainly nationally and globally. And we got stopped because, you know, the city, I think, didn't know what to do with us. It is the same problem I think San Francisco has whenever someone comes up with something that's a little bit different or that doesn't really meet their little checklist. They weren't sure how to permit us. They weren't sure what to do with us. They weren't sure who would regulate us. They didn't know if we had to talk to the SFPUC or PG&E or Recology or all of them. And frankly, we need to talk to all of them. And I think it's really part of the city's mission to help us talk to all of them. And it's also part of those big companies' mission to help this happen. You know, we're all in the sort of waste reduction business. I mean, San Francisco has a 100% waste reduction goal. The only way it's going to happen is if we integrate all of those resources together. I mean, it's a shame that our green waste, which includes our not-so-green waste from the dogs, goes way off-site to a biomass facility when there is actually a biomass facility at the wastewater treatment facility across the street from us. We could literally walk it across the street in a wheelbarrow if we were allowed to, but instead it has to be picked up by a truck and trucked off-site. I mean, it's just a shame. I mean, we're willing to do what we think is the right thing. We're willing to spend the time and the effort to do it. We really do think the city and the bigger players could help out.
And Helen, now to go back a little bit, because I just want to make sure we do get to run through the other pieces there. Can you tell us a little bit more about the other areas that we need to be taking into consideration when it comes to the environmental impact of pets?
Well, the other area, really, of course, is wildlife, is that we filmed both in San Francisco or outside San Francisco, and we filmed in Vancouver in places where dogs have a real impact on wildlife. And it's less than cats in many ways because dogs, of course, are generally under control. There isn't a feral dog population in the same way. In most places, dogs aren't allowed to just wander free, even if they're owned. They're generally with us, or if they're not, it's a mistake. They've taken off on us. So they don't have quite the same impact, but they do have a big impact on wildlife. And we filmed in Vancouver in Stanley Park, which anyone who's been to Vancouver will know. This is a beautiful park, 100 acres in the center of the city, that really is a stopping point for a lot of wildlife. And we have great blue herons that nest there in the park, and it's one of their stopping points. They're species at risk, which I didn't know until we started filming this, because you see them fairly often in Vancouver, and it just seems like they must be okay. They're all around us. But in fact, they're quite disrupted by the number of both people and dogs, of course. And because the park is so big, and this happens along the beaches outside, inside and outside San Francisco too, because the park's so big, the inclination, and I know this because I've done it myself, I don't do it anymore, it's one of the personal changes I've made, but the inclination is to let your dog off to have that good sprint down the beach. Well, of course, your dog sprinting down the beach is disrupting the wildlife on the beach. There are people that set their dogs literally to chase flocks of birds because it is natural to dogs and it looks like fun. One of the people that an ecologist that we filmed with in Vancouver talked about watching somebody set the dog over and over again into a flock of birds and how heartbreaking that was for her, because this is, of course, energy that these birds, even if the dog doesn't get a bird, it's energy that these birds do not need to waste. They're in balance in their world, and they need that energy to be able to feed themselves, to feed their young, to be able to migrate. And these constant interruptions of people and animals is something that's a big interruption for them. For the herons, they believe that they've changed their nesting spot once or twice, and they're now going much further to feed than they were because of the disruption of dogs and people along Stanley Park. So that's one of the big ones. You have the same issue in and outside San Francisco. We filmed a bird lover trying to stop people to pamphlet them, to tell them that this is a snowy plover area. And I'm sorry, at the moment, the name of the beach has dropped out of my head. Mark may remember it. But as she pamphleted people, a few people listened, and some people told her, you know, forget it, get a life, was one of the comments. One young man, I remember, leashed his dogs. And then I was watching a little bit. They, of course, didn't know we were filming. She was on a radio mic. And a little bit further down the beach, he lets his dog off again to go back chasing the birds because we don't get it. Our dogs are so precious to us that we want them to have fun. We want them to enjoy their freedom. We don't understand the impact they're having on especially birds, but also all sorts of other small mammals. I mean, I know my dog's perfectly capable of she's caught several skunks, unfortunately, so she's perfectly capable of catching wildlife. If I don't have her under control, she's a disrupting force. When there are now 84 million dogs across the continent, that's a lot of disruption.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the carbon footprint of pets with our guests, Holly Say, she's the author of Make Your Own Pet Toys, Helen Slinger, director of the film Dog Dazed, and Mark Clayman, founder and owner of Pet Camp here in San Francisco. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can post a comment at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or at the KALW website. Mark, you wanted to say something there.
Well, I think the point Helen makes about off-leash dog play is very important. We see that in San Francisco at Fort Funston and at Crissy Field and at Ocean Beach. You know, dogs that are taken there not only by their pet parent, where it's, you know, it's one person and one dog or one person and two dogs, where there is a lot of direct control, frankly, but we see it with the commercial dog walkers in San Francisco, too. And in fact, San Francisco is finally trying to regulate commercial dog walkers, and frankly, the fur is flying. These commercial dog walkers do not want to be regulated. They do not want to be told how many dogs they can have off-leash at a park. They do not want to be told how many dogs they put in their pickup trucks to drive them to the parks to then get walked around. So it's impacting both our natural environment, our urban environment, and our wildlife environment. But clearly there's a carbon impact of all these pickup trucks being driven around San Francisco with six or eight dogs in them.
And Holly Say, are you there? Finally?
Yes.
I'm Yay. Holly Say, calling us from Toronto, but actually here from the Bay Area. Welcome to the program, finally. We've been focusing quite a bit on dogs up until now, but now that we have you firmly in our phone line here, tell us a little bit more about the concerns that you are trying to bring attention to regarding cats and their environmental impact.
Well, sure thing. Again, I think with cats, similar to dogs, one of the biggest concerns is cat poop, right? I did some math once. There's something like about 80 million cats in the United States. And if every cat, say, used about 100 pounds of cat litter a year, it works out to, I think it was about 4 billion pounds of litter a year. Now, don't quote me on that number. I did that calculation a while back. I don't have it in front of me. But it was an astronomical amount in terms of how much waste there is. And then, as was mentioned before, there's the impact in California with the toxoplasmosis going into the ocean if your cat has that infection. So there's a whole gamut in terms of litter. And also, similar to people, as if people were saying, and dogs, there's the impact with food, there's the impact with toys. There's just so many different impacts. So while Professor Hart, like, I totally agree, definitely the people are making the biggest impact. I mean, the reason why I blog and what inspired me to write my book, Make Your Own Cat Toys, was that people really do, as Helen was saying, we hold our pets dear to our hearts. And pets are almost like children for a lot of people. And to ask people to, you know, when you come out with all these doom and gloom figures and then say, hey, you must change, it can almost be overwhelming. You don't know where to begin, and that's why I do what I do, which is to inspire individuals to make small changes so that they can, you know, move along that green continuum and feel more confident and feel more empowered in being able to make a change collectively.
Tell us a little bit more about the cat toy piece. It obviously inspired you to write a book. Why did you focus on that one area?
Oh, it originally started when I adopted my cat. I was working for World Wildlife Fund Canada, and so at work I was busy helping to save the environment. But at home, my kitten that I adopted, he was like a little, he was a hell kitten. He wanted to play all the time. If I didn't play with him, he would attack me, basically. So I was at the pet store, buying loads and loads of these disposable toys made in China. And I was like, this is not in congruence with what I do at work. And I was like, there has to be a better solution. So I started deconstructing the toys, and I was looking, going, these are made from very simple things that I have around the home, stuff that would either go in the garbage or be recycled. Why don't I just take this stuff and recycle it or upcycle it and turn it into cat toys? And that's how that originally started. And so my motto for the book is saving the planet one cat toy at a time. While I understand that's, you know, a little facetious, again, it fits into the idea that if we start making the small changes and we show people how easy it is to start very small, then they can begin to, you know, wrap their minds around making bigger changes for their pets and for themselves.
Can you give us a couple of pointers of things that people can do to make their own cat toys? And I imagine they can make their own dog toys too, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've seen dog toys. I don't have a dog, so I can't speak to that. But for cat toys, very simple toilet paper roll. You can make four different toys with that. You can just cut it into rings and then throw those. You can take those rings and then wrap them around each other so that they form a sphere, and then you have a ball. You can actually just give them the toilet paper roll. And then there's another one that I have on my book and my website where you kind of fold it and then you cut one end so that it's like a broom kind of, and then you can just toss that. So that's just a simple thing. I mean, bags, they love bags. You take the ties off the bags, you tie them together, you throw them. There's just so many things. When you start looking at cat toys and then you start looking at the stuff around your house, you start to get more creative and find ways that you don't actually have to buy these toys. So they don't have to be shipped from China. Or you can buy locally made toys made from organic materials. So you have a bunch of options there, not just for cats, but also for dogs.
Well, thank you so much for those tips. And we're going to come back to our conversation in just a moment. But as this is our spring membership campaign here at KALW, I want to take a moment to speak to you in the company of our general manager, Matt Martin, about why this is the time for you to take a moment and show your support for KALW and City Visions. Matt?
The number to call is 800-525-9917. You can also go online to kalw.org. Joseph, listening to this conversation, I'm reminded that the Bay Area is a place where we have so many intelligent, engaged people who are looking at problems far and wide and trying to find creative solutions to them, whether it's Mark Klayman with his pet camp, whether it's Holly Say, taking this idea of, you know, the make your own cat toys, saving the planet one cat toy at a time. Where but the Bay Area would somebody be thinking about that kind of idea, going forward with it and saying, you know, something definitely people have not thought about otherwise. That's the kind of voices you bring onto City Visions every week. And it's that commitment that we are asking you to support. The fabric of this community of people who are looking for creative solutions. That's what this station is about. And when you call 800-525-9917 or go online to KALW.org, you're strengthening that fabric. You're being part of it. That's what we're here to do at Local Public Radio. You make it happen.
1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. This is the time for you to show your support for programs like City Visions. The crew that puts this program together week in and week out loves to really find those innovators within the Bay Area and bring those voices to you and help you be part of the solutions of problems such as this one. Who would have thought that we could spend a whole hour on the intricacies of pet poop? 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
800-525-9917 or KALW.org. And we do have Holly Say's book, Make Your Own Cat Toys, yours for a $75 contribution at 800-525-9917, or you can go online to kalw.org and see more information about this gift and others we have to offer. This is our spring campaign where we're keeping it short, so Joseph is going to return to the conversation in just a moment. So we're asking you now, while you listen, go to the web, see what you've got there, what you want to, you know, kind of level of support you want to give. We have a goal in this hour of 12 people making a contribution, and if we make it there, Barry Thorne, a listener just like you, who said, I can put forward $800 to support this station. If we make it to that goal, that $800, that challenge will be met, and Barry will give that support to KALW. Be the next person to call at 800-525-9917.
Let's make this a successful, short spring membership campaign so that we can go back to the long form of radio that City Visions is an example of. So shorter is better, except when it comes to being able to dig into the details like we do here and we've done here for the past 21 years on City Visions and in many more years as KALW. 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Joseph.
And we're back on the program here, and we'd like to invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment at klw.org or on our Facebook page. And let's go to an email, actually, from Carl in San Francisco. I think this might be for you, Holly. It says, Carl in San Francisco, what are the environmental impacts of those high-tech kitty litters? Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, I wish he was a little bit more specific when he said high-tech kitty litters. I assume he's talking about there's these little crystal balls.
Hmm.
And in terms of that, I don't know specifically. I just know that what you want to do is you want to have a litter that is eco-friendly in terms of sustainability, made from natural elements, so I don't believe those little crystal balls are. You want to also use less of it. So I know with those, I believe there's a specific amount you're supposed to use in your box. So you're very much, for lack of a better word, chained to that brand of litter if you start using those balls. But if you use something that's natural or made from organic materials, it's something that at the very least you know in its production it is helping to reduce greenhouse gases. So if something is made from, say, I used to use an organic wheatgrass litter, you know the production of that wheatgrass is helping to take carbon dioxide out of the air, and that you know it's a renewable resource that continues on, so that at least also you know that it will biodegrade. With those little crystal balls, I'm not familiar with how they are processed in the environment and also the impact they have on septic systems. Hmm.
Can you say a couple of things about the concerns around clay-based and silica-based cat litters?
Yeah, there's a few. Clay-based litters are, the way they produce those, it's done in a process called strip mining. So what happens is they take the top layer of the land to produce this clay. It's I think it's called bentonite clay. And that means that the entire surface, so that entire wilderness area, is basically ripped up, and then the top layer, all that topsoil, all that natural, you know, meadow and grasses, it's all taken away just to take this layer of cat litter. And then when that material is removed, then there's just this barren wasteland that can never return back to its natural ecosystem.
And then my understanding is that, of course, then the cat litter is really not that biodegradable, if it at all, right?
Well, that's right, too. That litter, well, first, it can't be flushed. So if you are in an area where you can flush litter, you can't flush that litter. And I believe the EPA actually recommends that the best way to dispose of animal feces is to flush it if you live in an area where it is safe to flush it.
That's not California, but, however.
Yeah, not California. So this clay then ends up in the landfill. So if you do the math, like I said, it worked out to, you know, if it's 40 million or 80 million households with cats and all the cats are using 100 pounds of this a year, then it works out to this astronomical number every year of just cat litter, like billions of pounds of cat litter going into the landfill.
And I wanted to turn to you, Matt. We have another listener here who says, do different countries regulate pets differently than the United States? I'm not sure if you know anything about that, or perhaps, Helen, do you know? Because I'm curious what it is about Americans that make us perhaps so resistant to wanting to embrace the impact that they are having on the environment through the way that they are tending to their pets.
You know, I can't speak to the specific ways that other countries regulate their pets. But I mean, clearly, the United States and North America, you know, we've taken pets as part of our family. I mean, in the last generation, pets have gone from, especially dogs, have gone from outside the house to on the sofa. And I think that that's been the biggest part of the change about how we treat them and what, how we emote with them. But I don't think we're necessarily alone. I mean, you hear, you know, stories about France and Paris about dogs in restaurants. And so I'm not sure we're alone on this mission.
And Helen, do you have a thought on that question?
Yeah, I didn't look very hard internationally either. But yes, there's certainly, I think, different places. There are still many places in the world, of course, where dogs are food, in the same way that we in North America tend to consider pigs and cows food. So that's certainly a big difference. But even throughout Asia, where dogs have traditionally been considered food, they're now starting to be considered pets, too. But I think the thing about North America is it depends on, I think, the state of urbanization, almost. The places that we traveled, in the West, I found that there were still, and I mean both San Francisco and Vancouver, people still are used to having quite a lot of space and are slowly coming to grips, I think, with the fact that their dogs have impact. I think in places like Manhattan when we filmed, people seem to be very, very mellow around having their dogs on leash much of the time. It's hard for a Western dog lover who's used to a lot of space and a lot of off-leash space, but we saw a pretty happy accommodation in Manhattan with dogs allowed off-leash several places in the city from 9 at night till 9 in the morning, and then on leash at 9 in the morning, and everyone seemed to be fine with that. Now, what people are doing with the poop, bits. There were a few things being tried there around composting and turning the poop into compost for community gardens, but that was just an early venture. But in terms of facing those first facts that dogs are, they're very much part of our, I would correct Mark just slightly about it, is they've come from the doghouse onto the couch. I think they've come from the doghouse into the bed for many people. It's a surprising percentage of people that allow their dogs to sleep on the bed. So I think that is somewhat unique to the Western world for sure. But I think depending on how much space you have, people are learning a different round of accommodation. And perhaps that's also making us think a little bit more about impact.
And in your movie, did you focus on veterinarians and how much people spend on health care or life-saving maneuvers for their pets?
No, we didn't go very far on that. We did look at how much people spend on their pets, and it was a surprise to me that even through the recession, like, Americans spent a record amount, $50 billion on their pets in 2011, which is according to at least where I got the figure, double the U.S. budget for foreign aid was spent on pets, so that would include health care. So that's pretty astounding. It says a lot about how much we care about them, not necessarily about our understanding of their impact, but of how much we care.
So, right, and imagine that maybe some pet owners are spending more money on their pet's health than on their own, perhaps. Holly, any thoughts on this topic of just our connection to cats and how you see being able to create a palatable message for cat owners so that there is a way that we can actually open some discourse and not really sort of tune out what sounds like a very difficult message to hear?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, start small. I mean, even something as simple as food, because, well, let's look at face it, cats are very finicky. They don't like things to change. If you have a certain brand that you're loyal to, you can still have an impact and make your voice heard. You can contact the manufacturer of the food, ask them about their eco-friendly practices, if they have any, ask where their food is sourced from. You can even look at, well, if you're, okay, this, we talked about the animal byproducts. I know a lot of the people who are spending that billions of dollars per year are not feeding their animals the cheapest pet food out there. They're feeding them the stuff that is human grade or the stuff that is, you know, not the waste products of animal meat processing. So when you're looking at it that way, you can reduce your impact by looking at what flavors you buy for your pet. Same as for people, you know, it takes less resources to produce a pound of chicken as it does for a pound of beef. Or even something as simple, because as Professor Hart mentioned, just driving is a big impact. When you do your shopping for your pet, can you combine all those, you know, trips into one? When you buy your food, can you go out and buy the bigger container and buy more of it and just store it somewhere so that you don't have to make as many trips? So it's as simple as that.
So it sounds like you're really getting people to say it's not about, you know, the pet versus the environment. It's just, let's start to extend some of the common sense practices that people have been trying to incorporate into their day-to-day routines as humans and extend that to the pet realm. And then somehow, for whatever reason, there has been this sort of blind spot, and now it's not so different.
Exactly. That's it. Because with so many pets in the U.S., even if we make a small change, it still makes a big impact.
So just to run down a couple of things I found online here, get high-quality pet food, avoid packaging, or in your case, what you were saying there, Holly, is pick things that are in bulk so that you don't have as a lot of small packaging. Recycle, make sure you recycle all the pieces of the cans and the plastic food bags and other things. Try the vegetarian diet. I think we could probably have a whole hour on how to transition your pets to vegetarian diets. Staying with stainless steel or ceramic food and water bowls. Get those green biodegradable poop bags that you can use for the waste so that the waste can actually biodegrade. And then move towards more natural-based instead of clay-based litters like shredded newspaper, and then making those toys at home or using stuffed animals rather than the squeaky plastic stuff. And then be mindful of the carbon footprint of driving your pet around or driving around to get things for your pet. So just a couple of areas there. And I wanted to, in the last couple of minutes of our program, turn back to you, Mark Klayman. So tell us, what are the next steps in for Pet Camp, and how are you trying to get your neighbors and the broader San Francisco community to take part and pay attention to this matter?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to be an effort of outreach and working with others, both individual pet parents, both dog and cat pet parents, as well as the regulatory bodies and the folks we have to work with, our sort of resource partners, whether that's PG&E or Recology or the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, because I don't think any of us can make huge change on these issues by ourselves. You know, even doing things like getting flushable cat litter. I mean, no one's going to flush cat litter in San Francisco, nor should we. You know, the compostable poop bags that everyone's high on. I mean, if you actually take a compostable poop bag or a biodegradable poop bag and you put poop in it and you put it in a landfill, it's not going to biodegrade because landfills weren't meant to encourage biodegradation. They were meant to avoid it. If you have things that biodegrade, you're supposed to send them to a compost facility or a biomass facility, not a landfill. So we're actually setting people up to fail in many ways. We need to talk, frankly, at the state level about getting Class 2 compost facilities going in this state that could take meat-based waste. I mean, one of the big reasons we can't send dog poop or other poop from animals that eat meat to compost facilities generally is because they're all Class 1 and they don't want meat-based products in there. If we had Class 2 compost facilities that might be used to grow things that weren't used in the food source or in the human food chain, we might have a whole other opportunity to really think about ways to get rid of waste in a meaningful way. I think it's really a great opportunity for, you know, entrepreneurs, intellectuals, and pet parents to get together to try to solve a problem. But it's not going to be done by ourselves.
And Helen Slinger, where can people on this side of the Canadian-U.S. border see your documentary, Dog Dazed?
Well, it hasn't found a market in the U.S. yet. It was just released in Canada, but they could find it through our website, Bountiful, BountiFUL.ca.
Great.
Find get a copy of it there if they want. And one more thing I think we should add, fix your animal, especially your cats.
You sound like Bob Barker on The Price is Right there. And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Holly Say, writer about green issues for Catster.com, creator of GreenLittleCat.com, and author of Make Your Own Pet Toys. Holly Slinger, director of the film Dog Dazed. Mark Klayman, founder and owner of Pet Camp here in San Francisco. And earlier we heard from Professor John Hart of the University of California at Berkeley. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Our senior producer is Susie Britton. We'll be taking a break next Monday for Memorial Day. Join my co-host David Onick 2 Mondays from now on Monday, June 3rd. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week. I'll never look at a roll of toilet paper in the same way again. 1-800-525-9917 or klw.org. If you like this kind of radio and you like to keep it short, it's time to show your support for City Visions and KLW. 1-800-525-9917 or klw.org.
And it is time for As It Happens on KLW San Francisco.
Hi there, I'm Carol Off.
And I'm Jeff Douglas. Coming up on As It Happens.
Well, one minute, Mark Carson was walking along a Manhattan street with another man. The next, he was dead on the sidewalk. According to witnesses, the man who shot him shouted homophobic slurs before shooting Mark Carson at point-blank range. We'll speak with the head of a nearby LGBT community center tonight.
And we're going to hear about a victory for the little guy, the little inanimate guy.